This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
This is The Red Line, where we talk to three expert witnesses about one big issue shaping the news both here and overseas. And I'm your host, Michael Hilliard. When it comes to India, there's one quote that has always stuck with me. If you understand India, then someone's done a pretty bad job explaining it to you. And I cannot think of another nation around today that embodies that so very clearly. With India having so many divisions, languages, conflicting ideologies, and geographical challenges, it's frankly shocking the country has held together and done as well as it has. Just in my lifetime, I've seen India go from having a 1% share of the global economy to now having almost 5%. And that continues to grow each and every year. In fact, one of the only other big powers following that same path is just over the mountains in China. But emerging great powers competing is nothing new. We've seen it with Britain and Germany, even with the US and the Soviet Union. The difference is here that these great powers share a long land border, one where troops regularly engage in fighting. And it's not just problems along the edges of the country either. India has a lot of internal challenges to overcome first. Unlike China, India doesn't have the same centralization of governance. The people speak 22 languages, and the laws, rules, and taxes differ wildly between states. To get a product from the Taj Mahal in Agra to the port in Kolkata would require a 1,200-kilometer journey through four different states. But India still continues to grow. Business Insider predicts India will be the second or third largest economy by 2050. That's just 30 years from now. But how likely is that? What and or who could stop India from reaching its projected growth? And to start with, the list of who's is actually pretty long, as India has not always had the best relations with its neighbours, having been at war with every single one of them at some point in history. Even just recently, fighting with the Tamils in the south, the Pakistanis in the west, the Bengals in the east, and the other emerging superpower China, or along its northern borders. And we haven't even got into the Kashmir problem yet. India has enemies in every single direction. But which one of these poses the biggest threat? Which one of these will decide the Indian people's trajectory over the next few decades? Well, that's our question this week. Who is India's greatest enemy? And to talk more about that, we turn to our first guest.
Part 1. Surrounded.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, India is a large country, 1.3 billion people, second largest population after China, and probably set to overtake China in population by 15-20 years and become the country with the largest population. On the other hand, India's GDP per capita is hardly 1/4 or 1/5 that of China. So we are very long way behind China. But you could say potentially, in geopotential terms, India is the only country in Asia which could be some kind of counterweight to China in the 21st century.
Swami Natan Iyer is a renowned Indian economist and senior research fellow at the Cato Institute. He's also consulting editor for the Economic Times of India, as well as an author of a number of books on the geopolitics of the Indian subcontinent. And he joins us today.
Some people say India is 20 years behind and will in due course catch up. But India is a giant a sleeping giant for a very long time. It has potential. It is working well below potential. It has a number of internal political problems which it has not easily resolved. It does not live in a very friendly neighborhood. It has two very major problems with Pakistan on one side and China on the north, and has fought wars with these countries, and the military border with both these countries is unsettled. The world is also retreating out of the traditional international cooperation into individual country focuses, which again means that India is in not a friendly environment. It is not surrounded by friendly countries, and it is in a situation where it needs more allies, but frankly doesn't have any really deep relationships, deep friendships. So it is not a good position to be in geopolitically. And what India really needs to do is to become economically sufficiently strong that it can manage on its own without having to depend on a whole lot of allies, because it does have serious problems with its neighbors, and it's going to have to tackle most of them on its own.
China and India began their economic booms at roughly the same time, but you mentioned there that China's GDP per capita is much higher than that of India's. So why is India's rate of growth so far behind China's rate of growth?
More correct would you should be asking, how is China so far ahead? China had a rate of growth averaging almost 12-13% in the 2000s. So what China has done is the fastest in all history. India has been doing almost 7% growth for 20 years. That would qualify for a miracle economy. And the very fact that you call it miracle means that frankly you're doing pretty well. But you're not doing nearly well as China, which has broken all records. I would say that in some sense, China is following the same example done earlier by Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan. You have an authoritarian political model married with liberalizing, more open market economics linked to massive exports. So that at a very small scale, first of all, worked in these other countries. And the very fact that, you know, ultimately, Singapore is a kind of China. Hong Kong is a kind of China. Taiwan is a kind of China. And Deng Xiaoping was able to see that, you know, you don't have to give up political power to get market power by going towards the market and by going towards exports. And in effect, therefore, that's what he has become. It's a very, very powerful model. It succeeded in those small countries. It's succeeding in China. So it is. I would say there is no other model in the world that has produced consistent growth of 10-12% for so many years as in the case of China. So China has hit on a sweet spot. How long this will continue remains to be seen. It is now no longer going to get developing country treatment as it did in the past. It is now seen as a hostile political power in various places, especially by President Trump. And therefore, the kind of access it had to foreign markets, which it was used to, it may no longer get. So China undoubtedly is going to slow down. That slow down will perhaps give India a chance to catch up and go ahead.
So we don't have enough time here today to go through the full history of India without making this a four-hour piece. But to vastly oversimplify, between the years of 1858 and 1947, India was ruled as a British colony under the name the British Raj. The Raj contained the modern-day states of India, Pakistan, Myanmar, Bangladesh, and to a lesser extent Sri Lanka and the Maldives, with different people and religious groups living amongst each other throughout the Raj. Fast forwarding to just after World War II, with India making a push for independence and removing British rule. The British, though, volunteered to oversee the transition, and the decision was made that the Muslim families would be pushed into what is now modern-day Pakistan and Bangladesh, and the Hindu families would stay and live in India, with millions of families moving from one area to the other. Many of these lines and divisions on the maps were drawn up by the British in less than 3 weeks, and it led to heavy fighting, with millions of people dying in what is now known as the Partition of India. To this day, many famous Hindu sites sit in Pakistani territory, and many famous Muslim sites sit in Indian territory. And tensions, particularly between India and Pakistan, remain incredibly high to this day. But once again, I recommend you go off and read about the partition of India, as it's a huge subject in its own right, and I have skimmed over so much here. But setting aside Pakistan for the moment, I want to talk about the other Muslim majority nation, Bangladesh. What is the relationship like these days between New Delhi and the Bangladeshi or Bengali government in Dhaka?
It is an extremely good relationship by historical standards, because Sheikh Hasina, the head of Bangladesh, is probably the most pro-India politician in Bangladesh. To that extent, the relations between the two countries have improved very substantially. The amount of the commercial exchanges, the political exchanges, Bangladesh allowing transit between the two ends of India, between Bengal and the Northeast through there. India allowing transit from Bangladesh going up to Bhutan, Nepal and other places. Various economic deals that have been struck. So from that point of view, politically, the situation is much better than it used to be. But there is this dark cloud hanging, which is the issue of Bangladeshi illegal immigrants into India. The BJP has gone on the rampage trying to say that there are millions of such people and they have to be thrown out. Bangladesh denies that these are Bangladeshis, and certainly it will not take them back. And I think India has informally said, okay, we can't push them back. And yet the ruling party in India, the BJP, has this fundamental pro-Hindu, anti-Muslim bias in which it calls these migrants from Bangladesh termites tunneling their way into India and has promised to find various technical ways, passing new laws to throw them out. So you have this potential situation of tension that just as India has got the best possible leader in Bangladesh ruling right now, Sheikh Hasina, there is this dark cloud on the horizon. Now, whether India can actually go ahead with this, there are a number of political and legal hurdles. But there is a proposal that we'll have something called an All India National Register of Citizens, in which people will have to produce papers to prove that they are Indian. And India is a country with so many illiterate and poor people, they don't have documents. And if you don't have documents, under the Singh, you could then be disenfranchised and told, okay, you are not Indians. Along with that, there is a separate legislation saying there can be fast-track treatment for all migrants into India, provided you are a Hindu or a Christian or a Zoroastrian or a Sikh, but not if you are a Muslim. But if you're a Muslim who doesn't have these documents, in theory, you could be put into a concentration camp and held for detention with attempts to throw you out. So this particular thing, the BJP has been going on this internally as part of its internal program. And this certainly would be very disruptive for relations with Bangladesh.
Right now, the Bengali government is fairly friendly with India. But at the same time, more and more investment that is desperately needed in Bangladesh is coming from Beijing. With the increased reliance on China, do you think Bangladesh may flip sides to appease its creditors? Or are they going to remain politically close to New Delhi for a long time still?
No, I think every country in Asia was perfectly happy to say that we need finance for infrastructure and we're willing to take it. Earlier, the sources were mainly World Bank, Asian Development Bank, and now if there are these new Chinese sources, we'll take them. And let me add that there is this Asian Infrastructure Bank, of which China and India are both members, which at some time has been talked about as a possible rival to the World Bank. But over and above that, the Chinese banks are the giant banks, some of the biggest in the world today. So will Bangladesh be happy to tap those sources? The answer is yes. Let me add, India is also getting some loans from some of these banks where China is a majority partner. So everybody will go for China for infrastructure. Will that develop into a political relationship of the utmost importance?
a little more difficult to establish. But let's face it, if China is going to be the biggest economy of the 21st century, every country in the area is interested in having decent relations with that particular country. So even if Bangladesh wants to have good friendly relations with India, it will equally want to have good friendly relations with China. So at this point of time, all of India's neighbors, certainly Nepal, certainly Bangladesh, certainly Sri Lanka, they will all be looking, and above all Pakistan, of course, all looking to China for help with infrastructure, help with finance, which I think is fine. Just as America was the dominant source of finance and technology in the 20th century, I think China will begin to take on that role more and more in the 21st century, and that's okay. The only question is, does this mean that it is at the expense of India? I hope not, but that might turn out to be the case.
Well, let's move down to Sri Lanka now. The Sri Lankan government already has quite deep ties with Beijing, having taken huge loans from them a few years ago. And they're even in talks at the moment to allow China to build a large-scale naval base on the Sri Lankan coast in exchange for some debt relief. Do you think this signals a further shift towards Beijing for the Sri Lankan government, or is it just a consequence of being in so much debt to China?
As I said, every country needs money. And as I said, the source of financing earlier, World Bank and USA in the 20th century, and now it will be the Asian Infrastructure Bank and China in the 21st century. I mean, there's a shift. Where are the savings? Where is the money available? And China is there. In the case of Sri Lanka, they put up at Hambantota this huge port and airport in the constituency of the former president. And that was a pathetic failure. And being a pathetic failure, ultimately, China, in a sense, said, okay, we'll write off all these loans in return for operating this for 99 years. Now, some diplomats got very, very alarmed. They said China will do this in country after country, give large loans, they won't be able to repay, and then China will get what, in effect, might become a future military base. As of now, the Sri Lankans have said there is no question of it becoming a military base. But is it something that gives China leverage? Yes, it is true. So I think just as in the 20th century, when America helped out various countries with foreign aid or built projects out there, that gave them some local leverage. Something similar would happen in the case of China in the 21st century.
Before China's invasion of Tibet in 1950, Tibet used to be very close with India and quite often would align itself with the goals of New Delhi. But now that Tibet's been a part of China for almost 70 years, do you think that sentiment remains? If Tibet were to somehow gain independence today, would they realign themselves with India?
Look, Tibet is now Han majority. The local Tibetans are now a minority in terms of the population. So the idea of Tibet somehow becoming independent, I mean, this is 20th century thinking. I mean, there was a time when you could say that the Han Chinese were intruders. They invaded, took over Tibet in 1950. But by now, they have moved so many Han Chinese there that the Han Chinese are the majority. So when you talk about Tibet becoming independent, I mean, this might have made some sense when there was a local Tibetan population majority. But if the Tibetans, as they were historically called, are now a minority in Tibet, then I really don't see that there's any question of an independent Tibet. India has certainly not attempted to encourage the Tibetan refugees in India to think in these terms. India is certainly not going to try and say, let us try and support an independent Tibet as a move against China. Absolutely no. So I would say there's going to be no independent Tibetan movement of any significance. If it happens, India will not support that kind of movement. India will not want to ruin its relations with China, merely because there are some people who want an independent Tibet movement.
So jumping over to the Indian side of the Himalayas now, I want to talk about Nepal, which is currently being governed by the very pro-China Nepalese Communist Party. Nepal in control of many of the passes through the Himalayas between China and India, as well as being right next to the Siliguri Corridor, or Chicken's Neck of India, a roughly 20-kilometer-wide corridor separating northern Bangladesh from southern Nepal owned by India. It's been a consistent worry for the New Delhi government, as it's an only 20-kilometer gap, and if it were closed, 40 million Indians living in the northeast of the country would be cut off from the rest of India. And 20 kilometers is not that far to cut off. Do you think having a Beijing-aligned Nepal is a threat to the overall Indian security?
Nepal has always been chafed at the fact that its only relation, it's like a little landlocked country with the Himalayas as a border on the north and only India in the south as its neighbor. And it has these differences with India, various kinds. And it has always chafed that, you know, it has nowhere else to go. It's like under the thumb of India. That's how they feel. And would they be willing, would they be happy about diversifying their relationships by having roads and railways through the Himalayas to link them with China? They would welcome it, I'm sure. I'm sure, in fact, that even Bhutan, ultimately, if it had the chance, would want that. I mean, nobody wants to have only one single neighbor like India be large dominated. They would like to diversify their sources of supply, their trade, various things that they can do. So without doubt, Nepal will do its level best to improve relations. I think you're going to get roads and maybe even a railway through the Himalayas, which will one day connect Tibet and Nepal. And Nepal will try to use this in some of its old disputes with India, because, you know, it would love to have leverage using other people against India in some of those disputes.
During the Cold War, India was very close with the Soviet Union, doing large amounts of trade and buying almost all their arms from Moscow. But what is that relationship like today? How are relations between Moscow and New Delhi?
I would say it's about one quarter of what it was during the Cold War. In other words, it has by no means disappeared. But at that time, it was in some sense a dominant relationship. The overwhelming majority of arms came from them. And we could pay for those arms in rupees. We could pay for other imports from Russia in rupees. So, you know, it was not the foreign exchange problem that we faced in those days could be overcome in these particular ways with Russian help. And Russia was always a great help to India in the Security Council in debates on issues like Kashmir. So that during the Cold War, I mean, India was non-aligned, but very significantly tilted towards the Soviet Union. After the Soviet Union collapsed, the Indo-Russian relationship diminished very substantially. It is now getting rebuilt. Among other things, Russia is on its feet economically and continues to be an important producer of arms. India finds it difficult. India has a policy of diversifying its arms supplies and getting them cheap. So right now, there's a dispute between India and the USA on the fact that India wants to buy these S-400 anti-missile systems from Russia, just as Turkey has done. And the Americans are dead against this, saying this will affect, you know, our relationship with India. They're also saying, look, if you're going to have a close relationship, we can't have Russian equipment sitting in the same kind of area, which might be able to interfere or snoop into the American systems that the Americans are selling to India. Despite this, India, and therefore America, has threatened India, or for that matter, Turkey, with sanctions. There are American laws that enable such sanctions to be placed on countries that will buy something like an S-400 system from Russia. And yet Turkey has gone ahead, and India has gone ahead and signed and is going to get those systems. So the fact that India is willing to take these risks to keep this Russian link alive shows that that link within Russia remains an important part of Indian strategy. Russia remains also a supplier of various other kinds of arms. Russia, and they are cheap. The cost is much less. Russia remains a supporter India can rely on in the United Nations Security Council on issues like Kashmir. So there is the trade has gone down tremendously from the old days when trade was done in rupees. So the USSR is not a significant trading partner of India anymore. It used to be a much bigger trading partner in the old days. But it continues to be a country with which India is on friendly terms, and it is important for India in terms of military equipment and support in the UN Security Council.
And what about Washington? What is the relationship like at the moment between New Delhi and Washington?
Mr. Modi would like to pretend that relations are much better and they have a great personal relationship. I don't think that carries very much credibility. If you actually see what's happening on the ground, I do not think Indo-US relationships are doing well at all. Mr. Trump sees things in very transactional ways. So if he can sell India lots of arms, he thinks, relationships are improving. Or because of shale oil and gas production, if you can sell more oil and gas to India, trade is improving. But from the Indian side, many things are negative. India objects, for instance, to the fact that it's being forced to cut off relations with Tehran. India is fighting the USA on the threat of buying arms, especially the S-400 missiles from Russia. On the economic front, India used to benefit from something called the Generalized Scheme of Preferences, whereby India got duty-free treatment for a wide variety of goods, accounting for $6 billion worth. And the Americans said, sorry, India is too protectionist, we don't like this. And the GSP privilege that India had has been taken away by Trump. There have been negotiations for more than 2 years to try and reinstate it. Those negotiations have failed. So, things have not done well there. Finally, I would say India is very unhappy with what's happening in Afghanistan. India would want to see a larger American presence there. India would like to see a much tougher line against the Taliban. And the USA doesn't seem to be doing that. It seems to be just going away from that area. So I would say in various ways, are relationships better under Trump than under Obama? I would say not at all. I would say they're significantly worse, but neither country actually wants to say so. There is an improvement to the extent that India is now buying many more arms from America, that there are India has been designated as a major defense partner. So India has been helped by the USA to get into international agreements like the missile technology control regime and so on. So there have been some positives in that relationships. But on the trade side, on the economic side, serious negatives. And India is unhappy about the way the United States is behaving in Iran and Afghanistan.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
There is no doubt that China has been making aggressive pushes using financial diplomacy into South Asia, with most of India's neighbors now owing large amounts of money to its regional rivals in Beijing. But what is Beijing's overall strategy for the region? And what does the next decade have in store for these two regional superpowers, whose border is the largest mountain chain in the world, the Himalayas? Well, to talk more about the threat between India and China, we turn to our next guest.
Part 2. Buying enemies.
I would argue that it is probably China. China presents India with a challenge that is much more significant than what it has been accustomed to, along four key lines. So there is a boundary dispute which has heated up in the last few months between the two countries, and it's quite significant, even though it had been peaceful until June of this year, for almost 40 years, Effectively, China claims an entire state of India with populated, this is populated territory. So it's a quite a significant boundary dispute. But it goes beyond that. It's also, there are serious and growing concerns about Chinese influence in India's near neighborhood, including in, three of the three countries that received the largest amount of Chinese arms are all India's neighbors, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Myanmar.
Dhruva Jaishankar is the director of the independent security and strategy think tank ORF and a senior fellow at the Lowy Institute, as well as a former fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington. It's rare to find anyone around who knows more on the Sino-Indian relations and its current place in Asia than Dhruva, and we're very excited to have him on the program. He joins us today.
But you're also seeing a growing Chinese presence in the Indian Ocean as well. There are significant problems on trade and economics. There's a massive trade deficit that India has with China. Roughly for a couple of years ago to $60 billion, so about the same size as India's defense budget. And you see China opposing India at international institutions when most other countries, including the US, UK, France, and Russia, are often very supportive of India. So China presents a major challenge in a way that Pakistan, while Pakistan is so politically more sensitive in some ways than India, doesn't present India with that same scale of challenge.
Recently, we saw fighting break out along the Chinese-Indian border, high up in the mountains, with casualties on both sides. Looking at the footage, though, you notice both sides are fighting using bricks, sticks, and usually bare fists, rather than guns. And this is because Modi and Xi have had an agreement in place where punching, yelling, and spitting is okay, but guns are not allowed on these border patrols. This is usually done to make sure things don't escalate too far between these two major players. Do you think the current situation on the border is a managed conflict, or just the bare minimum to try and keep the lid on the whole situation?
So a series of protocols had been established since since 1993, a series of agreements up to 2013 that were basically meant to not resolve the boundary dispute between the two countries, but basically make sure that that the competition was contained. And so there were protocols established for what should happen if the two patrols from Indian and Chinese military patrols overlapped, which they did on a frequent basis. And there were protocols about weapons and how far away from the boundary they should be used and so forth. So those kinds of habits had developed over time. But I think what we've seen this year particularly is those habits break down quite significantly. Which is unfortunate, and I think in some ways this will require going back to the drawing board. I think there's an immediate issue of resolving the current standoff, which continues, but then there is a longer term issue of after that, how do you rebuild that level of trust that has been sort of painstakingly built up over more than 25 years. So all of this is to say that while there are still protocols in place in theory to defuse tensions. That there are serious questions about how effective they will continue to be going forward.
So neither side can actually agree on where the Indian-Chinese border sits. So what does the line of control actually look like over there?
The line of actual control, the LAC as it's called, is actually has three sectors. A western sector that in Ladakh, in the Indian Union Territory of Ladakh. The middle sector, which is Himachal Pradesh and Uttar Pradesh, or what used to be Uttar Pradesh, now Uttarakhand. And then the eastern sector, which is Arunachal Pradesh, which actually is the longest boundary. The current standoff is really focused on the western sector in Ladakh. And we have seen a sort of forward deployment of several divisions of the Chinese PLA to this area. They remain there, although in very narrow gorges. So there were roughly four points of forward presence by them, including in one area where they seem to have moved into what was previously considered as something of a no man's land. And so the question now is, while the standoff continues and there doesn't seem to have been major changes in the last few weeks, as long as it continues, we've seen the Indian government try and put in place certain punitive measures, mostly on the economic side. So this included the banning of a large number of Chinese apps on for mobile phones, including TikTok and a browser that is the second largest mobile browser used in India. You've seen a tightening, effective ban on Chinese companies participating in government procurement contracts in India, say for infrastructure and everything from oil rigs, things like that. So, and I suspect we'll see further steps in the coming weeks. So the idea is, I think what India is trying to show is we will continue doing these measures that will have both short-term and long-term economic consequences for China as long as this continues to play out. As long as there continues to be this forward presence by Chinese forces. So there hasn't been yet really an acceptance of a new line of actual control. I mean, we're talking in this case about a few kilometers forward here and there. So it's not a massive amount of territory, but it is part of what's considered a salami slicing tactic on the part of China.
So war between India and China would be an incredibly difficult campaign, with the Himalayas separating the two countries. So any invasion force going either direction would be funneled down a small number of slow, narrow mountain corridors, where columns of tanks would be easy pickings for aircraft. So with that in mind, do you think China would theoretically actually have the capacity to pull off a large-scale invasion of the Indian North?
No, so, you know, one is... the kind of mobilization that would require is today much more easily anticipated. There's much, you know, compared to 1962, which is when India and China fought this boundary war, which India was on the losing side of, and where China made deep ingresses, both a bit in the Western sector, but definitely in the Eastern sector. Compared to then, you know, the Indian military is much better prepared. So at that time, there were only two divisions on the boundary. Now it's a significantly larger number of Indian forces on the boundary. There's you have the ability to anticipate this movement. You know, basically in the form of satellite imagery and other forms of intelligence is significantly better. So you know, something like that, I think, is not really on the cards. And I think you also, you know, that kind of conflict happened before India, certainly, and China as well, had nuclear weapons. So, you know, there is a sort of nuclear dimension to all of this as well, which you know, hopefully does not come into play, but is something to consider. So if you take all of that, you know, I think this idea of large-scale conflict is not on the cards. But you know, what we are seeing are these sort of very limited movements, and in some ways not too dissimilar from what we've seen China do in the South China Sea, which is sort of slowly militarize what had been a disputed area. I think the difference here, one is it's on land, two it's this involves populated territory at some point, so it is in some ways more significant, but again, I wouldn't necessarily think that this will escalate to that level.
So what about the other way around? Would India, let's say, have the capacity to retake parts of Tibet that were once aligned to New Delhi?
You know, a forward ingress, at least a large scale, is very difficult. The terrain is really quite difficult to involve going through a number of passes. So I don't think that's on the cards. And India hasn't really invested significantly in an offensive capability. There is there are some mountain strike units being developed, but even that would have a very limited capability to make ingresses into Chinese territory.
Right now, there is a large talk about beefing up the Quad Agreement, a military cooperation pact between the United States, Japan, India, and Australia, effectively a thinly veiled anti-China pact. How significant do you think the Quad will be going forward? Will it be the basis of an Asian NATO, or just a lot of nice ceremonies with a lot of flags lying around?
So, I don't think it'll be an alliance, and I think the Asia-NATO comparisons are not quite apt for a few reasons, but one of them being that the U.S. appetite for alliances hasn't increased. In fact, it's decreasing, and we've seen that in the some of the frictions between the U.S. and its NATO allies, and certainly also with the U.S. and Japan and South Korea. So I don't think it will evolve into an Asian NATO. I think that's quite clear. But you know, it has formed. It has. It was resurrected in 2017, and it is basically a regular meeting of the four countries' foreign ministries. Initially at a sort of working level, but it has now been sort of punted up to a ministerial. They've met at least once as a group of ministers. And it serves two purposes right now. One is a political signaling to China that there is a sort of growing common agenda when it comes to regional security. The second is actual coordination. And we're seeing that, you know, the Quad in some ways has been a building block for some of the coronavirus coordination that is taking place. There are, in fact, two different formats, one led at by the vice minister or the deputy secretary of state in the U.S., and his counterparts, and one by the Secretary of State and his counterparts of the Quad countries, plus a few others, including, in one case, South Korea, Vietnam, and New Zealand, in the other case, Brazil and Israel. So the Quad, in some ways, is basically an informal coordination mechanism and is evolving in that direction. Separately from that, there is a trilateral naval exercise that is held regularly between India, the United States, and Japan. And there is some speculation that Australia, which was invited once in 2007, will be invited back into that, and that would become in some ways the mainstay for improving the military interoperability between these four countries. I think I suspect that that's only a matter of time before that happens. It'll either be this year or more likely next year. All of this is to say that I think we're seeing, you know, in some ways the more significant thing we're seeing is growing military contacts and interoperability between the four Quad countries. So India and Australia just announced a logistics agreement that would allow the two militaries to supply each other more easily. And India and Japan are now about to finalize a similar agreement. India already has one with the United States. So we also see secure communications agreements between the four countries. So the steps towards a greater alignment of these four countries are definitely taking place and have significantly accelerated over the last 5 years. Will that mean a sort of treaty alliance type system? I suspect it will fall short of that for the simple reason that the politics of the four countries does not really allow for that to take place.
In theory, though, if China was to form its own Quad-like organization, which nations do you think would jump in on the Chinese side of that?
Well, you know, the two closest relationships in a way, both complicated. I mean, Pakistan is by far China's closest military partner. It's a country with which China shared nuclear and missile technology from the late 1970s to the mid-1990s. It's a country where China is increasingly investing as part of its Belt and Road Initiative. So a major thrust of the Belt and Road Initiative is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. So Pakistan will definitely be a candidate for that. There was recently a meeting of the ministers from China, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Nepal, which raised a lot of consternation in India. But I think that some of that has to do with the present leadership in Nepal rather than a sort of deeper country-to-country relationship. North Korea is often cited as the other Chinese ally, but that's a much more complicated relationship. And there are hints that Kim Jong-un actually wants to distance himself a little bit from Beijing and have a strike out on a slightly more independent note. So the one thing I think when China looks around, it sees apart from Pakistan, it doesn't really have any close allies. I think the other countries that come close, there is a much closer compact with Russia, between China and Russia, which causes India a lot of discomfort, given that Russia is the largest defense supplier to India. And then in Southeast Asia, Cambodia and Laos are often cited as the closest relationships China has there, which it has used to undermine a consensus amongst the 10 ASEAN countries when they've tried to take a common position against China. So, I mean, when you look around, you know, when China looks around, I think those are the relationships, those are closest relationships it has. However, there are many countries where China now exercises quite a lot of leverage, and often in the form of economic leverage, that extends to large parts of Southeast Asia, to Africa, and even Eastern Europe.
The other area of competition between New Delhi and Beijing is the Indian Ocean. China needs the area to remain as friendly as possible, as the majority of its trade will travel through the Indian Ocean and then onward to China. But this is viewed by New Delhi as its own backyard, and that New Delhi should have control of this region. So how would you compare the Indian Ocean strategies of both New Delhi and Beijing?
Right. So I think it's very different. In China's case, it really started after about 2008 when they sent an initial counter-piracy mission to the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Somalia. And since then, you've seen effectively a permanent Chinese presence established. Their first overseas military base officially was opened in Djibouti in 2017. And since then, you know, that has actually focused more attention on Chinese, what are still largely commercial investments in several port projects in the Indian Ocean. And these include Gwadar in Pakistan, Hambantota in Sri Lanka, Chokfiu in Myanmar, and several on the East African seaboard as well. So far, none of those have really been militarized. The Chinese Navy uses Karachi in Pakistan and Seychelles and a few other places for some refueling. But there is growing concern that what is already a permanent Chinese presence in the Indian Ocean will become more consolidated. Now, India has, in some ways, natural advantages of geography. It is a sort of resident power in the Indian Ocean. It has assets in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands, just off west of the Straits of Malacca, where there is a sizable naval presence as well, Indian naval presence. And it is also what we've seen now in sort of in as a counter to the Chinese encroachment. Has been a number of steps taken by the Indian Navy, some of which are quite significant. One in 2017, actually, they completely changed their operational deployments. So there are seven zones in the Indian Ocean where the Indian Navy now has a permanent presence, meaning that there's always one ship or aircraft deployed there at any given time. There have also been a series of bilateral agreements that India has signed with several countries, including France, which has a number of islands in the southwest Indian Ocean, with Singapore and with others, that makes use of the facilities of those countries, wherever the Indian Navy can now use. And so you're seeing in some ways a real push to first find out in real time. I'd say another big significant development has been the establishment of an information fusion center in Delhi and in India that gathers information from across the Indian Ocean in real time there. So it's both, you know, satellite imagery from military aircraft, from radars. And so a number of these steps have been taken basically to better track Chinese military activity in the region. And also to deploy, sort of have a greater ability for the Indian Navy to actually deploy quite quickly around the region.
As we've discussed on the program a few times before, the Strait of Malacca between Malaysia and Indonesia on the edge of the Indian Ocean is the most crucial choke point for China, with a huge majority of China's shipping going through a narrow 1.7-mile wide gap. With India now looking to work with other nations to help patrol the area, do you think this will give India additional leverage against Beijing?
Right. So the Malacca Strait, you know, is patrolled basically by three militaries, Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And India has expressed interest in working with those three countries to have coordinated patrols in the region. This has been complicated by the fact that the three countries themselves don't have a coordinated approach. And so that has required India to actually try to work bilaterally with Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia, which is slightly more complicated, and to some extent Thailand as well. But beyond the Malacca Straits, actually, there are several other straits, the Sunda Strait, the Lombok Strait, that are in Indonesia, between the major islands there, between Sumatra and Java, between Java and Bali, which are sort of channels for both commercial and military vessels to cross. And a lot of this depends on, you know, what orientation Indonesia takes, and we saw a marked change in this in 2018, actually, where there was suddenly greater enthusiasm on the part of the Indonesian government to work with India and other countries on security matters. Some of it was motivated by the flare-up between Indonesia and China in the South China Sea. There's a part called the Natuna Sea, which is not strictly a territorial dispute because China doesn't claim Indonesian territory, but there is a dispute over the exploitation of natural resources, particularly fishing vessels. And so this actually led to This became a big domestic issue in Indonesia. They even led to some sort of blowing up of some Chinese fishing vessels. So in the aftermath of that, there's been a greater seriousness on the part of the Indonesian government to work with India and with other countries to shore up their capabilities. And one area of some discussion is developing their coastal Indonesia seeking Indian assistance to build up their coastal radar systems. To better track maritime activity. So this remains a very nascent stage. Another thing we've seen is Indonesia has become more welcoming of Indian ships. So there's a port in the northwestern tip of Sumatra called Sabang, which is not very far from the Indian Andaman Islands. And so for the first time, we're seeing Indian coast guards now vessels stop there and turn around from that point. So this is just shows some of the very new habits of cooperation that are forming between India and Indonesia. But there's still a long way to go, and a lot more. A lot will depend really on where Indonesia's strategic orientation in the long run.
The majority of India relies on a handful of very large and very crucial river systems. One of the main ones being the Brahmaputra River, which originates in Chinese Tibet. Do you think China has the ability to dam up these rivers and cause distress for the Indian population who lives downstream?
But the Brahmaputra River has been a point of concern for some time. China is building dams on the river and has been for some time. Until recently, it was quite clear that these were what are called run-of-the-river dams and were not diverting water, something which is very hard to do in that terrain in the high altitude of in Tibet. But that doesn't rule out the possibility of something like that happening in the future. And that, if that were to happen, that would be very significant. That would have consequences for Northeast India, particularly the state of Assam, where the Brahmaputra flows. But it's not an issue, frankly, that I've been following the last couple of years. But prior to that, third party or other investigation into Chinese damming activities in the Brahmaputra had suggested that they were not developing an ability to divert those waters.
So as you mentioned, China has a very close military alliance with Pakistan, the nation most people regard as India's ideological enemy, even helping Pakistan to acquire a nuclear weapons program, a program solely designed for a war with India. Do you think China has the diplomatic abilities to help push India and Pakistan towards war in the event that India were to pose an economic threat to China, so that way India and Pakistan destroy themselves while China remains relatively unscathed?
Well, I mean that posits the very unlikely theory that there'll actually be a nuclear exchange. But what we are seeing happen though is I think there's growing consciousness that the China-Pakistan relationship is much closer, and China will, in the event of greater India-Pakistan tensions, that China will be very much involved, and so you see quite publicly. Leaders in the Indian military talking about the prospect of a two-front war and having to at least contemplate and plan for that. So I don't really see that, it's very much part in China's interest to use Pakistan to keep India pinned down. But beyond a point, I think there'll be the linkage between Pakistan and China has now become much, much clearer in the minds of Indian military planners.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Since the very first day of modern India, New Delhi has been in conflict with Pakistan, its western neighbor. Having 10 standoffs or full-scale conflicts just in the short time that India has been a republic. it's no wonder that both Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, and New Delhi's foreign policies are so centered around defending against the other. The complicating factor now is that both sides have nuclear weapons, and both sides regularly fire upon one another. And now with China pulling the strings on Pakistan, New Delhi's two greatest enemies seem to be teaming up. So what does that mean for India? Well, for that, we turn to our third guest.
Part 3. A one-country foreign policy.
Well, I think for ordinary Indians, it's the issue of terrorism that Indians and ordinary Indians have dealt with over the last several decades. You know, terrorism not simply restricted to the borders with Pakistan, but Pakistan has been able to push that terrorism problem. In fact, at one point, many cities in India were facing this problem. We used to have very regular terrorist attacks in Indian cities, major urban centers. So there is a first-hand, very intuitive reaction to the Pakistan question. That Pakistan has taken bilateral relationship from a strategic level to one where even the people-to-people ties have been disrupted. The fact that there was so much potential, if you think about it, how similar the two countries were when they became independent, that potential has been disrupted because of the propensity of Pakistani elites to use terrorism as an instrument of state policy. And that means that ordinary Indians have borne the brunt of this terror question, and therefore their feelings about Pakistan are much more vivid. They are much more in your face.
Harsh Pant is a professor of international relations at King's College, specializing in the Indian subcontinent. He's also the head of the Strategic Studies Program at ORF, as well as an honorary director at the Delhi School of Transitional Affairs. And he joins us today.
But as you say, when it comes to Pakistan, the feeling is that Pakistan's shenanigans, Pakistan's use of terrorism has impacted many, many Indians very, very directly. And I think that's what leads to this, assessment of Pakistan being of a big nuisance. But I think anyone who, as you point out, those in the policymaking community have increasingly now recognized that India's Pakistan problem is now a subset of India's China problem. That the two don't exist in isolation. If you imagine a situation where Pakistan did not have the backing of China, then I think Pakistan would not be in a position to do even the kind of things that it is doing or it does even today. So because of the Chinese support, that element comes into place.
So a huge chunk of the India-Pakistan tensions comes from the dispute over Jammu and Kashmir. And once again, I highly recommend you go off and look up the history a little more, but for the sake of time, we'll just go over the very basics of the situation. When India was partitioned by the British in 1947, the continuous Muslim areas, or the majority of them, became Pakistan, and the Hindu or secular areas became the nation of India. And in the very north of the country, along the borders with China and Afghanistan, sat Kashmir. Kashmir's population were majority Muslim, but ruled over by a Hindu monarch. So when asked to pick a side, the monarch chose to stay neutral. In fear of losing the territory, Pakistani citizens rose up to overthrow him and secure the province for Pakistan. The monarch, seeing this happen, panicked and turned to India for assistance. India then sent in their armed forces to defend the monarch, sparking the first Indo-Pakistan War. The mountain fighting was absolutely brutal, with thousands of casualties on both sides. But the UN managed to broker a ceasefire between India and Pakistan. Neither side gave up their claim to Kashmir, but both sides withdrew behind the UN-brokered line of control, and it became a semi-de facto border. The aim was that this border would be in place until a fair and independent referendum could be held to let the citizens decide. That referendum, though, never took place. Now both sides have armies stationed on the border, regularly exchanging fire. This is one of the most tense zones in the entire world, and neither side wants to back down. Pakistan especially can't, because Kashmir is its only link with its major partners in China, and without it, China's use for Pakistan as a corridor into the Indian Ocean would be greatly diminished. And India knows this as well. So both sides' entire doctrines towards each other hinge on Kashmir. But what does the average person in India think of the conflict? Is it worth risking nuclear warfare with Pakistan over Kashmir?
Well, I think one, of course, there is a history, historical element there, which you would have discussed earlier. But the issue there is that look, here is a province which which was the Muslim majority province, and for different reasons, India decided to become part of India, and Pakistan since 1947 has been trying to make this case. That Muslims in the subcontinent or Hindus and Muslims in the subcontinent cannot live together. So in some ways, it's a question of identity for both India and Pakistan. For India, the identity of a secular nation where Hindus and Muslims can live together. For Pakistan, it is equally important to assert the identity of Islam by saying that look, there is Hindus and Muslims cannot live together, and therefore. Muslims need a separate homeland, and that narrative continues to shape the larger ideological battle between the two countries. India emerged after 1947 as a secular country with equal rights for all religions. Pakistan, of course, by very definition, emerged as a nation which was a homeland for South Asian Muslims. Now, clearly for Pakistan, that identity has not worked because we know that in 1972, you have the creation of Bangladesh. But I think the idea that, that Kashmir represents, that it was a Muslim majority state, that India, from in the Pakistani narrative, India controls, is something that Pakistan feels is imperative for Pakistan to get, extract from India. And that is something that Indians Indian policymakers of different backgrounds, of different ideological persuasions, have always been very, very reluctant to concede. And that is at the nub of this confrontation. Now, where the confrontation became almost militaristic, I think there you had the situation that right from the very beginning, Pakistan had been using military to claim that part. And 1947 conflict, for example, right after independence, right at the time of independence, the conflict starts. But those, we have had several conflicts along Kashmir. But I think, the idea that Pakistani military elite embodies is that they are the guarantors of subcontinental Muslims. That they guarantee the identity of Pakistani nationhood. And that identity relies on this anti-India argument, and somehow Kashmir is at the very core of that identity question for Pakistani military and intelligence elites. But I think for India, the question has been that as one of the most preeminent democracies in the world, what can it do to ensure that the democratic ethos also establishes in Kashmir? And therefore, once India started the process of elections in Kashmir, and the larger Jammu and Kashmir, after all, Kashmir is not simply Kashmir. When we talk of Kashmir, we talk of a larger space, which was at one point the whole state of Jammu and Kashmir, which has now been bifurcated last August into two union territories, which is the centrally governed geographies. One is Ladakh and one is Jammu and Kashmir. So you now have, Jammu and Kashmir as a space was never only about Kashmir Valley. There was Jammu and there was Ladakh. So that distinction has often been clouded by some of the things that Pakistan has been trying to articulate. Now there is an older issue here that there are certain areas of Kashmir which are also under the control of Pakistan. A part of it has been leased to China. So it is in totality, if you look at it, it's a very complex geography where you now increasingly have India, Pakistan, and China all having competing claims. And that is the reason why, for strategic purposes also, for India, it becomes very, very critical. Of course, there is a larger ideological reason. There is a larger reason of territorial sovereignty here. But I think also strategic terms, that region has become so important and so vital. And I think that contestation remains at the heart of India-Pakistan problem, as you were mentioning, and Pakistan's inability to also move away from this idea that this anti-India sentiment that has to be nurtured and that has to be built around which the larger Pakistani identity had to be constructed had also done great damage to this. Now, whether or not, my sense is that unless there is a domestic transformation in Pakistan, which allows Pakistan to get out of this, this ideological perspective, this perspective which basically defines Pakistan in anti-India terms, I don't think there is going to be a resolution to this problem. And I don't see that Pakistani military elites, at least, are convinced of this argument, because for them it is also about their own institutional prerogatives in Pakistan. So long as they are claiming to defend Pakistan against India, their sanctity, their status as the preeminent institution in Pakistan gets preserved. So I think there are a number of structural institutional reasons why the Kashmir question, for example, continues to be the problem, and why I don't think in the coming years as well there is likely to be any possibility of its resolution, a fundamental resolution. But I think what has happened is that India seems to have taken an approach that it can live with the present chaos in Kashmir, as Pakistan is perpetrating, and therefore India is now moving towards reconfiguring its peripheries, which it considers to be frayed. For example, the one that I mentioned last August, it deciding to take greater control of Jammu and Kashmir by bifurcating it into two union territories.
Both sides have impressive militaries, but when it comes to the sharp, mountainous terrain of Kashmir, fighting becomes incredibly difficult. So does either side actually have enough military strength to push in and take out the other by force, obviously without the use of nuclear weapons factoring into it?
I don't think so. I think status quo is the most likely outcome. That is why it has preserved so long. And I think what is also happening is that for many in India, it's also a question of what would India gain if, for example, there is a, there are many in India, for example, who would want those territories that are illegally, for example, from India's perspective, occupied by Pakistan to be made part of India. Now, the question is, what costs is India willing to bear to get them, and are those costs worth it? Now, for Pakistan also, this same conclusions apply, given what their economy is today. I don't think a war with India would make any sense. But I think, therefore, and that has been the situation for quite some time now. Pakistan has been in doldrums, economic doldrums, for a long time. It is only external help that is sustaining Pakistan. First, it was the American help during the war with Afghanistan, and now it's the Chinese. But the question is, and therefore the question for Pakistan is, do they really want to do that? So clearly they don't, otherwise they would have done that. The conventional war with India does not suit them. The conventional war with India suits no one. So I think clearly they know their limitations, and I think the larger cost-benefit analysis has been done. So the result is that you find other ways of bleeding India, other ways of creating trouble for India, and that is something that I think in some ways has been well documented. The issue, I think, has become more complicated for India now that there is enough evidence to suggest that Pakistan and China together are working in collusion more and more. So if you have two adversaries sitting on two sides of your borders working in tandem and increasingly coordinating their responses, then I think the challenge becomes a bit harder for a country like India. And therefore, India has been for a long time trying to get this, get a sense from China as to where it stands. Now, China clearly has made its stand very clear through its recent actions that it does not see, that previously it used to take a more nuanced, a more a neutral stance on the issue of Kashmir. It has really tilted now towards Pakistan. And that is something that will continue. So whether it was China going in for the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is part of the Belt and Road Initiative through the disputed territory in Kashmir, or whether China now challenging India on its borders through degree of violence, which is unprecedented, have sent the signals to India that the collusion between China and Pakistan is going to be the new normal that India will have to face, and Indian policy planners, defense planners are taking that into account. So I don't think a conventional war as far as India-Pakistan dynamic is concerned is something that the two countries would take in, the costs of that dynamic is something that the two countries have taken into account and will continue to take into account. But the question is whether that assessment that the costs are high lead them towards a resolution of this problem, which I don't think, because as I said, for Pakistani military, that would be the death knell of, once you say that let's give up Kashmir, come to an agreement on Kashmir, then what is left? How would Pakistani army sustain its centrality in Pakistani political order? At the moment, it continues to sustain that centrality by saying, look, there is an enemy in the form of India. We are the guarantors of your security. We protect you from India. And that is the reason why you have to keep funding us. And that's the narrative that the Pakistani army has been selling for quite some time.
Pakistan and China have become quite essential to each other. China in particular is investing heavily in the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, the aim of which is to be able to pick up and drop off resources on the southern coast of Pakistan, particularly at the Chinese-owned port of Gwadar, and then transport them via road and rail back to China. See, this would get around the problem of the Malacca Strait and the South China Sea being blockaded by the US, whilst also giving China a potent source of tension to ratchet up or release against India when required. Economically, their relationship is so intertwined these days, but how close is their relationship militarily? I mean, if India and Pakistan went to war with each other, would China jump in on the side of Pakistan?
Well, all the indications are that a relationship which was, which at one point or a decade back, perhaps we could have categorized as relatively skin deep, relatively superficial, has now become much more strategic. That relationship is evolving very, very rapidly. And at one point, many in India, for example, thought that as China really becomes a global power, as India rises in global power hierarchy, there'll be enough space for India and China to interact with each other on the Pakistan question itself, that China might be willing to, engage with India on terms that might be more beneficial. After all, India is a big market. India is a big trading partner, something that Pakistan does not offer. But what instead we have seen is that Pakistan's role as a strategic player in China's growing presence in South Asia and Indian Ocean region is something that is becoming more and more robust. And I think that is a reality that Indian policy planners are facing, and I think everyone else is also facing. And also, I think what has happened is India-US relations have improved and US-Pakistan relations have deteriorated. So Pakistan's reliance on China has also increased. Today, it is not simply US. It is, if you also look at very recently, just last week, the Saudis, for example, have now changed their approach towards, are changing their approach to Pakistan, are getting closer to India, and are not willing to give Pakistan the kind of resources that at one point Saudis used to give. That means, once the Saudis refused to bail Pakistan out, last week Pakistan went to China and asked for similar resources, which they got. Now, clearly, China also won some returns, and therefore China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is a big project. It's the largest project within the Belt and Road Initiative, very, very ambitious. And for that, as I was discussing earlier, China has been willing to face flak from India, because clearly that for the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which passes through what India considers disputed territory in Kashmir, China is willing to give Pakistan benefit of the doubt, which means that China is willing to signal that on the issue of Kashmir, it is tilting towards Pakistan, something that it had not done in the last few decades. So that shift is happening, where multiple realities, the geopolitical realities in South Asia, are changing. And as the US-India relationship advances, as US-China relationship deteriorates, as US-Pakistan relationship deteriorates, I think it's very natural that China and Pakistan will continue to look at each other, through lenses that perhaps they had not looked at before. And that means that the strategic nature of this relationship cannot be underestimated. Now, that does not mean that if there is a war tomorrow, China will come to India's aid. But it means that if there is a war tomorrow between India and Pakistan, China has many other levers that it can use vis-a-vis India.
Pakistan is also looking down the barrel of a huge strategic crisis as well, with the monsoons that feed the critical Indus River moving further and further east every year. Eventually, these will likely end up in Indian territory. So what will Pakistan do when a huge chunk of their water supplies ends up in India?
Well, Michael, I think, this water question is also very interesting, because you also have the question that India has raised vis-a-vis China. So this is also a question of what happens to the larger water management issue in that geography, which is certainly is going to be shaped by the way our environment, our climate change issues are dealt with. But I don't see the possibility, at least in the short term, of any armed aggression from either side. I think what is also interesting is that despite some in India suggesting that India might have to rethink its approach on the Indus Water Treaty, for example, I think the water management treaties, the water engagement between river water engagement management between India and Pakistan have held their ground. So far, at least. And I don't see that getting transformed into a large-scale military conflict, at least in the short term. Partly because this is an interlinked question. This is not simply about India and Pakistan. India and Pakistan. This is also, I think, it involves a much larger geography where you have to look at it all the way from China to India, including Bangladesh. There is Nepal, there is Pakistan. So almost all these countries in the region are interlinked in more ways than one, as far as the water management issue in the region is concerned. And so any dyad taking, using the military for that purpose might not work for the larger region, and might create more complications, because other countries will also have a stake in what needs to be done there. Whether it will hold permanently in the future, if the crisis materializes in ways that perhaps we have not envisioned today, remains to be seen.
Do you think India is at risk of China using countries like Pakistan, the Seychelles and Nepal to surround them, or is that just paranoia by the Indian part?
I think, I don't think India suddenly tomorrow going to be surrounded by a number of these outposts. Certainly China has plans, China has engagements with many of these countries. But I think the real issue here is the very extensive engagement of China in India's periphery. And an engagement that has been growing over the last few years, and that has suddenly become exponential in its growth. China is the largest trading partner of several countries in South Asia today, if several of India's neighbors today, including India. China is also looking at extending its naval presence in Indian Ocean region, which at one point was seen as something that China would not, would be beyond the scope of Chinese capabilities. So in a sense, over a period of time, as Chinese capabilities have expanded, Chinese interests have expanded, and they are being manifested in their presence in South Asia and Indian Ocean region, in countries from Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Mauritius, Maldives, Nepal. All of these countries, at one point in time were close Indian friends. They still are close Indian friends. The only difference is that these countries today have another friend, which is China. And these countries feel that their foreign policy is best served by using both powers to their advantage, which, you know, I think they are doing very, very effectively. But what the real issue here is that China is today the most one of the most important players in South Asia. India has to take that into account when it frames its foreign policy. And it is not simply a question of India and China. It is also a question of the agency of small states, of smaller states in the region. They also have agency, so they feel that they can look at these two major economic powers, political powers, military powers, and they can benefit from them by playing one off against the other at times if need be. And that is the reality that we are living in. You know, this is the reality of our times. And this is something that India will have to take into account as it goes forward in framing a response to China, as well as in framing its bilateral relations with these countries. Because clearly, in you know, the older template that India may have had in when it comes to dealing with its neighbors may not work today, where the neighbors also have options of a powerful country like China. There are many problems with Chinese engagement in the region, including, for example, the very famous word that is often used, debt trap diplomacy. But India's inability often to deliver on the ground, to convert its promises into operational outcomes, is something that has always been a problem. And where China has delivered, India has not been able to deliver. And there, the real competition between the two countries like India and China comes to the benefit of these smaller states, which are shaping their own foreign policies based on their foreign, based on their relationships between these two countries. And oftentimes this results in playing one off against the other. But I think the larger issue that India will have to grapple with is that China is a presence in South Asia, in the larger Indian Ocean region, and India will have to find an adequate response to manage that challenge. Now, all of these countries are different than Pakistan. As we have been discussing Pakistan in, for the last few minutes, Pakistan stands out because of its very identity-based requirement of anti-India foreign policy. But other countries are much more nimble. They are much more, they define their foreign policy in terms where India is not the enemy around which they have to define their foreign policies. So clearly for them, engagement with India and China is both beneficial, and at times, they play one off against the other. And that's the reality of South Asia and Indian Ocean region today, and it will be for some time in the future.
As we said at the beginning of this story, it is far more complicated than we could ever do justice for within 90 minutes. And I'm sure we will be revisiting Kashmir in its own piece sometime soon. India's relationships are fluid and changing, and it's not always to India's advantage. To start with, whilst Bangladesh is friendly today, governments change, and as Bangladesh continues to be smashed by rising sea levels and worsening monsoons, the need for foreign investment will continue to rise. And as we know, China will likely be there to help. The debt trap will get bigger and bigger. And much like we're seeing in Sri Lanka, Bangladesh may not have any choice but to give China what it wants, even if it's sympathetic to the government in New Delhi. Nepal is also slipping away from India, looking to China to escape the fact that due to its geography, it has been at the mercy of Indian foreign policy now for decades. And now, with its current allegiances, China controls many of the crucial passes through the mountains, leaving Beijing in control of what comes in and out of those passes. The other worrying factor here for New Delhi is the fact that Bhutan is in an incredibly similar position, and might start having those conversations as well. The big obvious one, though, is Pakistan, and this is the one China crucially needs to keep on side, as the two countries' strategic futures are now intertwined. But what should India do about all this? Because there aren't that many good options on the table. In the current situation, China can build infrastructure and reserves in India's national enemy's heartland, supply Pakistan with weapons, and even assist Islamabad to export terrorism into India, and further cause headaches for the government in New Delhi. The status quo doesn't favour the rest of the Western world either, as the entire strategy of Chinese containment, of choking China into the South China Sea, has just been worked around by using Pakistani ports in the west of the Indian Ocean. what would have been a huge pressure point to wield against Beijing has just been severely dulled. But we also can't forget it's also hellish for the people living in these disputed Kashmir zones as well. In the Indian zone, India regularly cracks down, shutting the internet off to the region for days and months at a time. Unemployment is high, and there is very little autonomy for the region these days, especially with this current Hindu nationalist government sitting at the helm. But living as a Kashmiri Pandit is horrible as well. Kashmiri Pandits living on the Pakistan-controlled side are regularly killed and slaughtered in large numbers by the Pakistanis. And due to the conflict and visa troubles, many of these peoples cannot return home, simply because of a line on the map. There is no security for these people, and to be honest, no end in sight either. The status quo has so many problems with it, but what can you do? Any war India launches against China will quickly become a two-front war with Pakistan. And even then, India's trade deficit is far too high. You also have the added complication that the country India gets most of its weaponry from is Russia. And Russia is much closer with China at the moment. And in the event of a war, they may not sell everything that India needs to carry it out, favoring the Chinese side. So you turn towards the United States and look at reforming the Quad. But that won't save the situation either, as Japan and Australia are still incredibly reliant on Chinese trade. And the US doesn't seem to be in any mood for its current alliances, let alone new ones. Even with just a limited war localized to Kashmir, the fighting would be far too tough, with the mountaintops of Kashmir being an almost impossible place to conduct military maneuvers, without losing thousands of your own men to do so. And the moment you do that, China will flood the area with cheap weapons, as it would love nothing more than to cripple the one nation that may pose a challenge in its grand ambitions throughout Asia. Culturally, though, this conflict may be baked into the cake. Even last year, when we saw Pakistan and India exchange jet bombing runs in Kashmir, both sides worked very hard to avoid casualties, miss their targets, and exchange pilots. Because both New Delhi and Islamabad know how quickly the rhetoric and momentum of war can take over and force India into a conflict it could not likely win. As we said at the start of this piece, if you think you understand India, or you think you have the solution to the problem, you may need to think again. Thank you so much for tuning into the program. This episode was one of the most requested pieces we get, and we are thrilled to finally get the chance to work on it. I'm sure it will not be the last time we visit the conflict between India and Pakistan. Last week was also a very special week for myself and the show, as we just clicked over our 500,000th stream after just 9 months of doing the program. I never even dreamed that we would get anywhere near this. Even now, when I look at it, I'm still just so thankful for all of the love, support, and feedback we've had from you guys towards the show. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you. I'm more than aware, though, that this would not have been possible to achieve without the amazing support from our Patreons. Their donations to the show, whether it be a monthly donation or even just a one-off, mean the absolute world to us. It really does help with the costs of running a show like this. Every dollar from our Patreons goes straight back into the program, so we can chase bigger and better stories for you guys. And to say thank you to our Patreons, we do live Q&A sessions between the Patreons and myself, and we've just booked in dates for the next one. So if you are a Patreon, you should be getting an email from me tomorrow night. If you would like to jump onto these Q&As and ask me any burning questions you might have, or even just support the show, we would be incredibly grateful for your donation. Right now, we're saving up to be able to afford to turn these episodes into short videos and help us bring you maps and animations and bring the show to a wider audience. But if you want to support the show in other ways, you can follow us on social media platforms on the handle at The Red Line Pod, or find myself on Twitter at Mike Hilliard Oz. Oz is in Australia. A big thank you goes out to all of our guests as well. You can find Swami on Twitter at SwamiAyer1, or visit his website, swaminomics.org. The website contains a fantastic collection of books and research papers done by Swami, and it was fantastic to have him on the program. Dhruva was one of the most switched on people I have ever had the pleasure of working with. I am very sure Dhruva will be making a huge impact on the region over the next few decades, and we will hopefully have him back on the program sometime soon. So if you want to find more of his stuff, you can find him on Twitter at D_Jashanka. Harsh and his work at King's College are incredibly highly regarded, and we can see why. He was amazingly insightful when it came to understanding the internal dynamics of the region, and I highly recommend you check out his books, Indian Foreign Policy and China Ascendant, as both of them are some of the best around on this subject. Another thanks goes out to one of our Patreons, Gokul Sani, who helped me out with some of the research for this show. He does some amazing writing over with 9-Line, a website all about the geopolitics of South Asia. I recommend you go check out his stuff, and if you want to find him on Twitter, you can find him at Gokul_Sani. As always, I want to thank Nick Munch and Joe Hawthorne, who helped out with this episode. And of course, the amazing Mark Spence, who does the additional voiceover that isn't mine on the program. I really couldn't ask for a better team, and you guys are the reason we can do this show. We'll be back in another fortnight with another international episode. Once again, to everyone who tuned in, sent through an email, DM'd me on Twitter, I read every single one of them. And I have loved catching up with so many of you over the last few weeks for a chat or a beer online. I am always consistently amazed with the people I meet through the show. So if you ever have a question or just want to chat or just want to ask anything of the show, please feel free to DM me. I do read them all. But that's all for this week. So until then, thank you and good night.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.